relationship and
Yeah, that's okay. I'll try to find something related to that to talk about. So the hopefully enticing quote was from is from Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, book 1, verse 21. For those who seek liberation wholeheartedly, realization is near. For those who seek liberation wholeheartedly, liberation is near. One that I didn't include that just follows is how near depends on whether the practice is mild, moderate, or intense. That's usually the verse that we don't really want to hear. It basically says that it has something to do with our degree of relationship and application of our own practice. That it doesn't just kind of descend on us, liberation. In fact, I was, unfortunately, as I always am, just saying to someone that self-liberation is not a noun, it's a verb. You don't acquire it. You don't get it and kind of keep it. You don't even stumble upon it or step in it. Kind of interesting discovery on the bottom of your shoe. You do it. Self-liberation is something that we participate in. Thus, if you seek this action wholeheartedly, it is near, but it depends on you. And we have thousands and thousands of years of text that point to different modes of connecting with that self-liberation. Slightly unfortunately for us, a lot of them point to ways in which we can do it in some variation of a cave. Some form or fashion of something quite far away. In fact, I was looking through the Dhammapada, and one of the essential things was that you live far away from others. And the Oxherding tales talk about going away up onto the mountain, away, away from everyone else, and finding your realization, and then coming back down to actually manifest it. What about those of us that choose to be here with everyone else? What about those of us that find ourselves in the ridiculously uncomfortable position of actually having to deal with other people? What do they have to say about that? It's pretty thin, actually. But at least the Yoga Sutra tells us that sickness, apathy, doubt, carelessness, laziness, sexual indulgence, delusion, lack of progress, and inconstancy are all distractions that by stirring up the patterns of consciousness, they act as barriers to our stillness. Which stillness? The stillness out of which arises the pure awareness that enables us to connect with our self-nature. Sickness, apathy, doubt, carelessness, laziness. Any of these sound familiar?
No.
Sexual indulgence. Delusion, lack of progress, and inconstancy have our work cut out for us, is what this is saying. When they do, one may experience distress, depression, or the inability to maintain steadiness of posture or breathing. Posture, interesting choice of words. And so here we are. Yoga is talking about postures all the time, isn't it? In fact, everything we hear about yoga talks about postures. And so immediately we're thinking, well, what does Ardha Mukha Svanasana have to do with relating to other people? Quiet as kept, the Yoga Sutra as it was written had nothing to do with the Hatha Yoga body postures. There's about 3 lines in all 195 sutras of the sutras that are actually dedicated to speaking in any way, shape, or form about what we in the West most focus on when we say the word yoga. Yoga is, in fact, from this particular perspective, is strongly, by this time, influenced by the rise, and then by this time also a little bit of a fall of this interesting fellow referred to as Buddha. On the other hand, this interesting fellow referred to as Buddha was strongly influenced and no doubt practicing the yoga that is then captured in this sutra. So it is all mixed up, and here we are in the West acting as if they are entirely separate from each other, and either you're a yogi or you're a meditator, either you're a Buddhist or a yoga something, and there it is. Every once in a while, the yogis, you know, will sneak in a little bit of meditation. And every once in a while, these meditators will, you know, get a little yoga on. Hatha yoga, body yoga, yoga of the body. And in general, we have kept the philosophies very, very far apart. We have seen them, and they have been presented to us as quite far apart. To settle that debate with not a whole bunch of information, but just a couple of lines that point to 4 things that may be familiar to those of us that have had any experience with the Buddha Dharma, the Dharma of the Buddha. The Yoga Sutra goes on to say that consciousness settles as one radiates friendliness, compassion, joy, and equanimity toward all things, whether pleasant or painful, good or bad. Anyone recognize those 4 things? They are commonly referred to as the Brahmaviharas, the 4 divine abodes, or the 4 immeasurables. This is not tucked away in the back of the Yoga Sutra index someplace. This is right there in book 1. It is the first thing mentioned in a list of potential practices. The very first thing. I could go on. Some of them will sound familiar to you. They say you can also pause after breath flows in or out. You can also steadily observe as new sensations materialize. Does that sound familiar? or when experiencing thoughts that are luminous and free of sorrow, or by focusing on things that do not inspire attachment, or through meditative absorption in any desired object. And then it goes on to talk about but for today's purposes, I'm going to actually turn our attention to this, verse 33, because it might be helpful in relationship to this business with working with others. Consciousness settles as one radiates, we don't mean in the mirror, one radiates towards others friendliness, compassion, delight, and equanimity toward all things, whether painful or pleasant, good or bad. I'd like to stretch this out a little bit. In the Brahmaviharas, the reason they're often referred to as the four divine states or abodes, because they're associated often with the qualities of a bodhisattva. This gives us a little bit of confusion. So first of all, bodhisattva, as we pointed to before, is one of those debonair beings that decides to hold off their own awakening for the sake of all others. Baptist Christians have this very frequent saying that if one of us are not free, then none of us are free. This threads through a lot of different teaching, and yet it's a teaching that we can sometimes leave aside and go scurrying after our own awakening. As if somehow, once we discover our own true nature, it won't be soiled by the folks that are nearby. Because that tends to not necessarily be truth. I mean, has anyone ever experienced that? There you are in a perfect state. Everything is wonderful. You got it. You finally nailed it. You're humming along. You've got your Mai Tai and a little beach chair, and it's all good. And somebody comes along, and their dog thinks that right in front of you is the place to kick up sand. Or some kids go scurrying into the water and bring the entire ocean on top of you in your utter perfection. Now, you know, maybe it's not a Mai Tai, maybe it's not on the beach, but we know what this sounds like. It sounds like our mothers and our brothers and our uncles, and our bosses, and our next-door neighbors, for heaven's sake. Anyone. The people that live in that other country. Right? The people that are like that, you know, they don't meditate. All of those other beings that are somehow not like you are the ones that soil your perfect, perfect life. So, if you happen to run across this circumstance, which maybe that's not true for you, but just in case, I'm going to elaborate on those four abodes, those four states, so that you might have something useful. Radiating friendliness is fairly easy when other people are radiating friendliness back at you. Right? I mean, you know, you get on the bus and someone smiles at you and it's pretty easy to smile back. And there you are, self-congratulatory about how pleasant you are. How about radiating friendliness towards those that are in a state of constant openness and presence? It starts to get a little edgy there. When someone else is in a constant state of friendliness themselves, we start thinking, yeah, something's not quite right. And before you know it, what seemed like a perfectly reasonable thing starts to disturb us a little bit. They're friendly, I'm friendly. That's great. They're friendly, I'm friendly. Wonderful. They're friendly, I'm kind of in a bad mood today. What's going on here? It begins to irritate. Radiating friendliness towards someone that is not in a constant state of friendliness and openness themselves, but is actually in a fairly constant state of, let's just say, unfriendliness. Let's just say someone that is in a fairly constant state of misery takes us even further from our perfect pleasantry. So really, this radiating friendliness, finding your place, finding home, abode, in a place of friendliness, whether someone is particularly when you find people that are always friendly and always not friendly, are real practices. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Each of these abodes have near and far enemies. The near enemy are the ways in which we confuse the teaching into being something that's not quite right. The far enemy is when we just go off the deep end into the other direction. I will tell you that obviously, for us, the far enemy is obvious. It's the near enemies that are tricky. Because it's the near enemy, and we say near, not just as in they're close, but as they're so close we don't recognize them. The near enemy of friendliness is undue self-affection, a kind of over self-interest and ticklishness with your own being that basically devolves into self-involvement, right? That it disables your ability to be in relationship with what's going on around you. So we can take radiating friendliness and be just kind of there's a word that escapes me. Can be just sort of overdone with ourselves, kind of guffawing everywhere we go, overshowering of affection that is no more connected to you and the other person than, well, you know, Iraq and the United States, far apart. Compassion has a near enemy, which is pity. we think often that if we feel bad about someone and their situation, and we kind of furrow our brow, that is compassion. Nothing in ourself truly moves. We simply send towards them a sense of they are in a lesser position than we are, and thus they need our pity. The near enemy of compassion is pity, and we see it abound. The Dalai Lama often refers to that as being idiot compassion. This is very, very challenging for us, because we like to think that as long as we feel bad about someone's situation, though we're not inclined to do anything at all, or, in fact, we are over-inclined to do something and project our own sensibilities onto the situation, that makes us compassionate. I did it out of compassion. Of course, I completely brought my issues to the situation and made a mess of the thing, but I did it out of compassion. They needed my help. Whenever you start talking about what someone else needs from you, you are probably hanging out with the near enemy of compassion, which is pity. Yes. Whenever you start becoming involved with the idea of what someone else needs from you because of what they're experiencing, you are probably hanging out with pity. So someone needs something from you, and only you can give it to them. Only you have the answer, and surely you must do this because you're compassionate. You're probably hanging out in pity. This is very tricky for us because we think, well, isn't compassion being moved to action, to do something for someone? When you are telling yourself a story about what needs to happen, I guarantee you have left your home. Does that make sense? When you need to convince yourself, say what needs to be done, you know, get out the script about what needs to take place here, you have left a centered place and gone to a place of pity instead. The far enemy of compassion, which is fairly obvious, is cruelty. A reckless disconnection from what's going on with the people that are near and far from you. We think of cruelty as actually doing something to someone. If we do something awful, then we're being cruel. Cruelty is actually a reckless disconnection. A reckless disconnection. And the reason I say a reckless disconnection is because there are some situations that we don't know about. A few of them in the world. And so being able to be aware of absolutely everything is somewhat on the left side of impossible. And if we beat ourselves up and try to make ourselves connected to every little thing that's going on, we are just, you know, heading off the deep end of self-involvement again. A reckless disconnection means that we have awareness of something as it occurs and cut ourselves off internally so as not to feel with the situation. And therefore, we eliminate our relationship to what's going on. And that disconnect is cruel. So it's something like, in the big picture, I got an email when we reached 3,000 U.S. soldiers dead in Iraq. And the email went on about how there was going to be a ceremony. It was an invitation, and there'd be a ceremony to read the names of the 3,000 soldiers aloud. And I got to the, I already had the feeling of discomfort creeping across. And at the very bottom of the email, it said, "Of course, we recognize that there are many, many thousands of Iraqis dead. And we'll hold space for them too." And that was it. That was the end of the email. This is reckless disconnection. This is cruel. In fact, it would have been better to not even have mentioned them. And because what it caused is the need to actually shut off from that awareness in order to move forward. This was cruel. Does that make sense? On the other hand, close by, we have people that suffer great trauma or discomfort or distress in their lives. There's nothing we can do. So what we do is that when we see them, we just act as if it hasn't happened. "Hi, how are you?" We keep moving. Out of our own discomfort, because we have nothing to offer. This is also reckless disconnect. Because we don't know what to do, we do nothing, not from a place that's responsible of, "Wow, I really can't do anything," but we do nothing in the sense of cutting ourselves off from the entire relationship. So the near enemy of compassion is pity, and the far enemy is cruelty. From there, we are told that joy or delight is another thing that we can radiate in order to help settle our own consciousness. This joy is not friendliness. It's often translated as empathetic joy. So it actually doesn't mean your own individual joy, but actually joy that comes about as recognition of someone else's success or happiness, or their own joy. Also starts to be a little challenging for us. Just right off the bat, what this is asking us to do is to recognize when other people are joyful, that we should just be joyful with them. Which means that we have to put our greed aside, our jealousy aside, our self-pity aside, our poor me, why am I not in that situation aside. And that doesn't make any of us particularly comfortable. Now, if there's someone that we know and we love, we can be joyful at their joy. So if you deepen this, what you want to do with joy is to actually discover how to find joy with people that have more than you. So when there's someone that has something and that you maybe wish you had, whether it is something material, whether it's some kind of attainment, they have some position, or they just have a state of being that you would like to also enjoy. Practice joy, empathetic joy, with those people and see how far your practice takes you. The near enemy of joy is kind of a over effusiveness.
Right.
Someone comes and they're like, "Well, I got the new job," and you're kind of happier than they are, right? You just jump off the jump up and down, and you know, get kind of crazy. That's so great. That's, you know, I'm not quite feeling effusive enough to fake it, so. But you know what I mean. To be over effusive. In a similar fashion from to friendliness, but disconnected, in which it's disconnected, where that joy is coming perhaps from a place that is forced, that is pushed. And obviously the far enemy of that joy is to have aversion. And so when you see someone experiencing something that is positive and they feel joyful, you yourself moving away from them. The last one is equanimity. In different times, I have said that this is actually one of the few teachings that are laid out backwards. Equanimity is actually the first practice. Equanimity means to maintain a sense of balance regardless of the situation. Equanimity means to hold a place that is even when the situation and the relationship with other people is good or bad, pleasant or painful. Without equanimity, it is actually impossible to practice the other of the abodes. If you cannot yourself remain in balance, regardless of the situation, you cannot discover your own friendliness. You cannot discover your own compassion. You can't discover your own joy. The near enemy of equanimity is detachment. You think of being, having equanimity as just like, you know, being Zen. No attachment to anything. And that just because you're cool and detached, therefore you are radiating. On the other hand, the far enemy of equanimity is, again, similar, over attachment to the situation. Right? So joy's far enemy is aversion, and equanimity's far enemy is attachment. And so you get involved in people's experiences and emotions and their situation. So you throw yourself into the situation. Now, how does any of this actually help us work with other people? Like most of the teachings, the four abodes are pointing to our need to cultivate our own inner relationship in order to be in relation with others. Both the teachings of the Buddha and the teachings of the Yoga Sutras are pointing to the very same thing, which is we must cultivate our own wholeness, our own sense of balance, our own internal sense of joy, compassion, and friendliness in order to be able to have that with others. If we don't do this, not in a cave, out there with the rest of the world, we have not a single chance of having any real relationship. Because when a relationship is out of balance, it simply cannot be sustained. Any relationship that has imbalance will eventually fall apart. On the one hand, one person will be resentful, and on the other hand, the other person will feel disrespected. Does that make sense? And all relationships go out of balance, all of them, for some period of time. But they must find balance in order to be sustained. Imbalance in relationship cannot be sustained. Imbalance in yourself cannot be sustained. If you are out of relationship with yourself, you will be out of relationship with everything and everyone around you. If you are out of relationship with everyone and everything around you, well, I mean, you just might as well go home. There were a couple of kind of movements towards questions, so I just want to check if anyone had any specific questions.
Yes, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we get caught in this, the language. Mm-hmm. And so we'll have to sort of forgive the language and know that we're talking about the qualities ultimately in the essence. I like to use detachment as being the thing that keeps us in disconnect. And non-attachment as something that is cultivated that enables us to be clear seers of the situation. I like to use it. I will, for sure, you will go places and people will turn it, right? And so the difference between non-attachment and equanimity is really internal. And it's about whether or not what arises in you is a desire to grasp the situation, whether emotionally, physically, or mentally. So if you're feeling, and obviously by extension acting on, a desire to grasp after the situation, to become locked in to whatever is going on, then you are attached. And so what we cultivate is a sense of unlocking ourselves. It's like Velcro that has all these little hooks. I'd like to say unhooking, right? And so getting unhooked from the situation, which doesn't mean leaving. It just means getting unhooked. So detachment is leaving, even if your body is still there. Mm-hmm. So when Elvis leaves the building, this is detachment. But when you can remain present, seeing clearly, and yet not glomming on, not becoming Velcro, then you're practicing non-attachment. And let me just say that equanimity is a very, very deep practice. I began to point to earlier, and I lost my train of thought, that one of the things about the abodes is because they're associated with bodhisattvas. We think of them as mistakenly as states to be attained once you get there. And they're practices that never end, which is why they're also called the immeasurables. The depth of those these practices cannot be measured. How far you can take them cannot be measured. There is not an end point that you get to and you're done. They are both the path and the goal. And for not just the 2,600 years of the Buddha, but for likely at least 5,000 years of the yogic practices, these have been pointed to as essential to being in a relationship and essential to clearing one's consciousness of disturbance. It's a bitch. You could just say it. Al Gore stole our title Dharma should have been called an inconvenient truth. It really,
you know, there it is.
For those who seek liberation wholeheartedly, realization is near. It's not convenient. And it is not at our behest. It's not on our time schedule. It doesn't happen when we want it to. Such is the great mystery of truth with a capital T. Discerning point of when to act. And since our home here is rooted in the transformation of the society around us, we want to know, when do we act and when do we just let go and let God, as they say? Let it be. It's not yours. I don't have a convenient response to that. But I have a really simple one. You will know. You will know. And it is unassailable. Nothing anyone can tell you will stop you. Nothing about the outcome. Nothing about the logic, nothing about right or wrong or indifferent, nothing. Nothing will stop you. And when you need to let it be, and you know that, nothing will move you. Immovable. Solid. You will know that your place is to simply be in relationship with it as it unfolds and not move a muscle. Action only arises out of this clarity of stillness. We must get to the stillness first. We must get to the stillness first. And if we don't, always our actions will be confused with our own grasping, with our attachment, with our need to make things as we would like them to be. And our view is limited, limited, limited. In the meantime, you will make mistakes. Okay.